It's no secret. I like science. Just ask the members of my Wednesday night class how often I bring up scientific explanations to relate to what they are studying. My interest in science began when I was very young. I had a neighbor that was about 4 years older than me, and he built a 4-inch telescope. It was a reflector telescope, and it was amazing what you could see with it. And his hobby was astronomy, and so he knew all about the stars and planets and the sun and the moon, and he showed me sunspots and craters on the moon and rings around Saturn and the moons of Jupiter. And for a little kid, I mean, this was great stuff. And it just perked my interest. In fact, on a clear day, we lived in Los Angeles, California, we could point the telescope across the valley, and we could see the telescope on Mount Wilson, the observatory that was there. And they had a 100-inch reflector telescope there, but they wouldn't let me use it. There were radio towers up there as well, and so it was just really, really a neat thing to do, and it just perked my interest. My parents occasionally would take me to the Griffith Park Observatory, and they had a planetarium, and that was really neat. And that's the big dome you see on the screen there, and they also had a telescope. They had a 10-inch telescope. And when they would give a show, a lot of times they would then say, afterwards, come or come in the night, and you can look at what we were studying, a particular planet or a star or the moon or whatever. And so as you can see, I had a great childhood to continue my interest in science. In 1954, I began my engineering education, and it lasted until 1963. And so I want to set the time frame of what's going on in the scientific world at that time. Okay? There had been a famous experiment done by Miller and Urey about the origin of life. You got to realize I'm not a Christian, and so I'm buying totally into the theory of the day, the scientific theory of the day, evolution. And here was an experiment where they put some gases in a chamber that supposedly represented the primitive atmosphere on the Earth. They sparked it, and they circulated it, and they had some liquid there, and so this was to represent the primordial soup that was on the Earth millions of years ago. And they collected some goo, and sure enough, in that goo, they found amino acids and peptides. And these are the building blocks of proteins. And so they said, see, we have a mechanism by which we can bring about life. And it was the goo to you theory, or it was the molecules to man theory. 1954. Okay, so we get our education done, and in the 60s, there's the God is Dead movement by the philosophers of the time. And a fellow wrote a book, Von Hanian, whatever. Anyway, that's his name. And it was The Death of God, the Culture of Our Post-Christian Era. Okay? And in fact, on the cover of the April 8th, 1966 edition of Time magazine, there was an article in there that was concerned about the movement in America, American theology that arose in the 60s, known as the Death of God. So this is what I'm growing up in, and I'm going to college with this material surrounding me. And so I kind of want to ask the question today, and this is based on a presentation that I saw on the internet that Buddy Payne did just probably a month or so ago at Auburn University. One of the churches there assembled a bunch of people. And is it reasonable to believe in the God of the Bible in this age of enlightenment? Is it reasonable? Okay, now you know my background. And there's, you know, two basic views that you have to consider. There's the proponents of evolution and the proponents of creation. And the core ideas are that for evolution is that life in all its forms emerge from a simple substance by natural means. You can explain it by natural means. Science will explain how life came about. But the proponents of creation would say that life in all its form is the result of intelligent shaping of matter. There's intelligence behind it. We're not going to use the word God, we're just going to say intelligence here, or the intelligent design movement that people are talking about. Two basic views. Okay, our class Wednesday night is Why Believe the Bible? Okay. And it's material that's current, written by Doe Moyer. He's one of the professors at Florida College. Written a lot of papers on apologetics, and he's done a very thorough job of presenting material, Why Believe the Bible. Some of the illustration work has been done by Victor Moyer, who's married to somebody we know from this congregation. And Leon Malden also has some photographs in there. Okay, here's just the table of contents. I don't know if you can read it or not, but basically, Doy is helping us say that our faith is built on evidence. And we're looking at biblical things and the testimony of the witnesses that were with Jesus, and is it reliable, etc., etc. And right now, we're just down to lesson 3. Dave will probably complete it this Wednesday night. The claims that Jesus made, are they reasonable? Is there evidence to support that they are real? But tonight we're going to jump down to lesson 10 and look at some evidence that God has given us that is extra, that's outside of the Bible. Some arguments that people make about the existence of God. Okay, and that's what we're going to look at tonight. God's provided us with two revelations. His Word. Genesis 1:1, John 1:1 say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So the Bible claims to be the Word of God, and that God is the creator of the universe. The Bible also says that we can use creation as a word, as a revelation about God. And specifically, if we look at Psalm 19, written by David, and Romans 1:20, written by Paul, we read the following. David says in Psalm 19, the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is the declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. And so as this young lad growing up in Los Angeles, peering at the stars, God was speaking to me through his creation. I mean, I was blown away by the number of stars that I could see. We have a lot of light pollution today, but when I grew up in Los Angeles, I saw a lot of stars just with my naked eye. But Paul really nails it down. He says, for since the creation of the world, his, referring to God, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Look around. Look at the heavens. look at what God has made, and just look at creation, and you should see God revealed in it. And so that's what we're going to talk about, just one aspect of that tonight, where I think if we want to talk to somebody about God and not use the Bible to make them understand that there is a God, or make them think about it's reasonable that there is a God, we're going to use God's second revelation, His creation. That's the world, natural world. We're going to use that as evidence. We're going to leave the Bible out of the discussion. And the tack that Buddy took was, let's talk about E.T. Let's talk about extraterrestrial life. Okay. Is there life outside the world we know? I think the revolutionists would say, absolutely. Let me show you how they might reason this. Okay, let's go back. When I was a kid growing up, we had science fiction, Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon. Anybody heard of them? No. Oh, good. All right. Yeah, they were in comics, they were in movies, radio programs. We had radio then. But then later on, of course, there were movies like E.T., and then there were series, TV series, Star Trek, and there's movies, Star Wars, and there have just been many, many other media presentations of the fact that everybody knows there's extraterrestrial life out there. After all, our star, our sun, we call it, it's a star, is just one of 100 billion stars in our galaxy, the Milky Way. And if you want to know where we are, we're right there. That helps a lot. And the reasoning is, 100 billion stars in our galaxy. We happen to have a star that's the right size, and we happen to be in a planet that is the right distance away from that sun, and we happen to rotate just at the right speed so that we don't get burned to a crisp and freeze to death. You know, if a day was a month long, we'd burn up, and if nights were a month long, we'd get pretty cold. And we know these things because we deal with them, because we put people in space and we do things like that. Okay. 100 billion stars. There has to be another star the same size with planets that are in the right place. And if evolution is certainly the mechanism by which we came into being, just within our own galaxy, there's got to be a lot of planets that are occupied by living beings. But let's even go further out than that. The universe now, they estimate that there are 100 billion galaxies. So that does it. We know for sure there's got to be people living out there. How do we prove it? How do we find out? I mean, that's a good question. What will we do? We're smart. How can we come up with a way of determining that there are living people out there? Are there signs of intelligent life in the universe? Well, there's an organization called SETI, S-E-T-I. Actually, it was supported by tax dollars for a number of years. Now it's funded privately. And it's Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI. And one of the professors at Harvard, I think it's, I'm not going to get this name right. Sorry about that. Senior moment. The program continues to this day with private funding, and what kind of evidence would convince you that there are ETs? And that's what they're going to do. They're going to search to get some evidence to convince mankind that there is extraterrestrial life. Okay, here's a picture of the website describing this organization, the SETI Institute. This is that privately funded institute. This is an old rendition of the website page. The first line reads, SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is an exploratory science that seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. They're not going to bring people back. They're not going to identify certain molecules. They want to see if there is some kind of signature that there is intelligence out there. This is what the new website looks like. The sentences, the words are the same. They're just showing you what they're using is radio telescopes to listen. They're listening. They're searching. They're scanning the sky and they're looking for narrow band signals. Basically, here's a quotation. Virtually all radio SETI experiments have looked for what are called narrow band signals. These are radio emissions that are at one spot on the radio dial. Narrow band signals are the mark of a purposely built transmitter. Natural cosmic noisemakers, such as pulsars, quasars, do not make radio signals that are this narrow. They're broader. When you listen to a radio station, you're dialing to a particular frequency, and that transmitter is by law only allowed to transmit its signal in a very narrow band. So if you hear something that's coming to you from outer space and it's a narrow band transmission, you can infer that something intelligent behind it has produced that transmitter. I'm a radio ham. I have a transmitter. I transmit on the frequencies that the FCC allows me to use. Certain bands. If I get outside those bands, I get fined. I might even have my license removed. So that's what they're looking for. They've been looking for a long time. Haven't found anything yet. Okay, now I already said this. They can infer intelligence without identifying what that intelligence is. Maybe it tells me who wrote the book. Is it Stephen Jay Gould? I'm not sure. Or is it the other guy? Anyway, somebody from Harvard who was very much involved in the SETI movement, they didn't find anything, so they wrote a book. And they made a movie, too. This is the picture of the movie. And guess what? They heard something. They heard beeps. Beeps. And pauses, and beeps, and pauses. You know, in amateur radio, the Morse code is dits and dots, you know. This was like missing information or a noise. So it's just beeps. And when they listened carefully, they listened that the beeps were kind of not just random. They were beep, single beep, and then a pause. And then the next one was three beeps, beep, 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 and then a pause. And the next one was five beeps and a pause. And it went on like this. And they recognized that these are the prime numbers. Mathematicians know what that means. Okay, prime numbers. So this is not just random beeping out there. This is intelligent transmission, narrow band, signifying we have brains. We're smart. Okay? And of course, watch the movie if you want to see the rest. The point is, they were able to listen to a narrow band and determine, based on that message that was coming across, that there was intelligence behind it. They got a signal from space, and it wasn't just random noise, and they said, that's coming from an advanced civilization. So the question you ask is, well, if we received the message from space with a language we could decode and read, would that impress us? That there is intelligence involved in producing that message. I mean, if you heard Morse code coming from some distant star, would you say, there's a radio ham up there. Maybe that's what's producing this message that we're getting. Okay, well, what are we getting to? There are signs of intelligent design right here on Earth. And we're not going to get into the detailed chemistry, which I would love to do, but we're just going to kind of go over it slowly and easily, and we're going to stop to tell you that in every living cell, it's full of signs of intelligent design. Every living cell. Okay. And in these cells, there is a language which we have learned to decode and to read. We're talking about DNA. And as we continue to do the research on DNA, we see more and more that there is design inferred in what we understand about the DNA. Let me just kind of go aside here. As my class would say, you're going down this rabbit trail. And it's just that as I've certainly been involved in the sciences for the last too many years to count, there are times when scientific evidence comes that can be used to support the theory of evolution. And it's kind of scary. You know, there'll be some find, some fossil, something that they will basically make the headlines, evolution supported by this evidence, etc. I have learned that over the years, just be patient. Just be patient. Don't worry about science proving that evolution is true. The more science, which is knowledge, grows, the evidence will continue to support the existence of God. Sometimes the evidence is a hoax. Sometimes it's just misinterpreted. The one thing that I think you can give science credit for, majority of the time, when they see evidence that contradicts the conclusions that they made before, they will just basically create another scenario. In other words, they won't continue to try to push it. Although I'm a little bit nervous today that the educational system is such that they've sort of locked out the other view right now. But be patient. Okay, so we have research on DNA, which is continually done day and day, and of course they're looking for good things to do with this information in our lives to improve our lives. Okay, let's go back to where this all kind of got its origin. A person by the name of Charles Darwin, you'll see his name emblazed on MIT building out there. You know, he's a god as far as evolutionists are concerned, because he is the one that sort of wrote in his book, based on the things that he observed in nature, that it's possible that everything that we see today evolved from simple life forms even further back, just simple molecules. And the reason for that was that at that time, the ability that we had to look at bacteria, small things, was not very good. And so when they looked at a bacteria, they said, well, here's just a glob of molecules, and it has the ability to reproduce. And then if these globs of molecules get together in a certain way, pretty soon you might have some more sophisticated glob of molecules, which actually begins to look like some sort of critter. And then eventually you have fish, and then you crawl out of the sea, and you have everything. And so that's the reason we have this evolutionary tree proposed. Today we have peeled back what this simple bacterium looks like. And it isn't simple at all. It is a very sophisticated and complicated creature with lots of chemistry going on inside, and we're beginning to understand it, and we can read it and we understand it. And what we found out is that all these cells have DNA in it, and the message that's in the DNA is the message that tells this bacterium how to make itself. And there's a lot of machinery around that it has to use. So it's sort of like, okay, here's the blueprint for making another bacterium cell. Now I got to go to the factory and get out my tools and grab a hold of all my chemicals and put the molecules together to assemble another bacterium. But it's all there. And for instance, this little critter happens to have a tail on it, which it can actually move around with, so it can find food and stuff like that, or nutrients, or whatever it might need. And when we look at that little gadget, that little flagellum, that it's really marvelous. It's a well-designed motor. It's got a rotor, it's got a stator, it's got U-joints, it's got all kinds of things. Some 40 different proteins are involved in just this bacterium's ability to move around. All right? So the simple bacteria that Darwin thought about when he put together his theory isn't simple at all. In fact, it's a very complicated piece of biochemistry. Okay, and this is just another picture showing it's got cell walls, and there's some of the machinery inside. And in the nucleus, you know, see those little spiral-looking things there? That's the DNA that's inside there. Okay, DNA. When it was discovered, people looked at it, and just looking at it said, wow, that had to be designed. I mean, it's just this double helix spiral. It has this characteristic structure, the double helix with crossbars. And it has the ability to reproduce itself. My understanding is that a virus is just this. You know, you got bacteria, which has got all that machinery, but the virus is just basically just the DNA. And so it has to invade somebody, some cell, and say, okay, make me. You know, turns the machinery on that the cell has, and it says, make me. We get sick. Okay, the DNA has the ability to unzip, to come apart. And what's kind of neat is that the things that hold it together, these crossbars, consist of just four kinds of molecules. We call them A, C, and G, and T. Why? And they can be read. The order is important. Because every three letters is a word. This shows what the A molecule looks like, and the T molecules. You got adenine and thymine and guanine and cytosine. Fancy names. I like A, T, G, and C. The other thing that's interesting is A always binds to C, and A to G, it's right here. A to T. It's right here. A to T and G to C. They always stick together that way. Okay. And when they come apart, then the only thing that connects is the opposite one. There's always an exception. The T ends up, they put a U on it. But don't worry about that. Okay. I don't want to get too complicated. It's too complicated for me. So here we have this DNA molecule. It's a double helix. It's got these crossbars that are A to T and G to C. It can unfold. When it unfolds, something else can come in and connect to it, and it always follows the right pattern. But then if you look at a single strand, and you look at these letters, A, T, G, C, whatever, the sequence, if you take three of them, it's a word. The next three, another word. The next three, another word. We've got a language. And in fact, there it is, A to T and G to C. Oh, I thought, these things are called base pairs, by the way. That picture, this is called a base pair. This pairing is called a base pair. So, what do we know about this? Well, in the simple bacterium, you can have anywhere from 1 to 10 million base pairs in a single strand of DNA that's inside that nucleus in that bacterium. 1 to 10 million. If you take any cell from our body, a human cell, we have 3 billion base pairs. Okay? And you know what? We now have mapped out the whole DNA molecule for human beings. We know where all the letters are. And we know the language, and so we know what they are talking about. Okay? And what they are is they're telling the story of how to make the proteins that make up our body. The skin cells, the eyeball cells, the bone cells, whatever. And every cell, no matter which type it is, has the whole blueprint in it. The DNA that's in there is the whole thing, the entire blueprint for how to make you, all the parts of your body. The one thing that they determined was that only 5% of the human DNA is being used to make up the body proteins that we need. And therefore, the evolutionists have said, we got the proof. 95% of the DNA, 95% of the base pairs in the DNA are useless. They don't make proteins that we need. They call it junk DNA. They say that's the stuff that's left over when we came out of the pond scum and moved along the evolutionary trail. If there was a God, why would he make 95% junk? Patience, remember? Patience. Okay, this is just the language. And this gets complicated for some people if you only haven't seen it for the first time. But this is the three-letter language. You have the first position, you have the second position, and the third position. And so if you saw, for instance, U, G in the second position, and let's say A in the third position, this would be telling the story, stop, terminate. And then after that, start reading. And each combination of letters that comes up with a word has, these are the words. These are the words that you can write with the A, G, U, and C. Notice a lot of them are the same. And what are those words? They don't mean anything to me, but they're amino acids. And proteins are made up of amino acids. And you just string them together in the right order and you get the right kind of protein. That's enough. Moving on. So this code, this genetic code, this combination of base pairs that can be read, basically code for the 20 common amino acids that build all the proteins in living things. So the blueprints, when it uses the machinery, can make you, any part of you that needs to be made. So what do we have here? We've really got a message in this living thing that shows intelligence. You can't convince me that this just happened by chance. This is a language. This is not just a series of prime numbers. This is words. This is a language. And certainly, if SETI got something like this from space, they would declare, we have discovered life in space. So is it reasonable to believe in the God of the Bible in this age of enlightenment? And I think the answer is a resounding yes. We just looked at one of the things that we can, through nature, see, and Romans 1:20 says, observe, you're without excuse if you don't see God there. In fact, there was a philosopher, professor of philosophy, a former atheist, an author and a debater. His name is Anthony Flew. I believe he is English. He's dead now. But in 2004, he was elderly, But he came to the conclusion, he says, it now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided material for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. So Anthony Flew had to go to where the evidence led him. He saw that every living cell is full of signs of intelligent design, has a language that can be decoded and read, and it continues, research on DNA continues, to reveal signs of design. Well, let's get back to this junk DNA. What about it? 95% junk. All that's saying is that we know the 5% that makes the proteins that we need for living. We don't know what the other 95% does. Not yet. Be patient. Well, it turns out that a book has already been published. It was published last year by Dr. Wells. He's a research biologist at the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. He holds two PhDs, one in molecular and cell biology from the University of California at Berkeley, and one in religious studies from Yale University. So he's gone to good schools, he's got the papers, and he's been reading about, now this organization he belongs to is a creation, it's an intelligent design kind of organization, and they're looking at stuff. His preface basically says the discovery in 1970 that only a tiny percentage of our DNA codes for proteins prompted some prominent biologists at the time to suggest that most of our DNA is functionless junk. Although other biologists predicted that non-protein coding DNA would turn out to be functional, the idea that most of our DNA is junk became the dominant view among biologists. So we're going way back, 1970. So that's the view, that's their bias as they continue to do research in DNA. And he says this view has turned out to be wrong, spectacularly wrong. Since 1990, and especially after the completion of the Human Genome Project in 2003, many hundreds of articles have appeared in scientific literature documenting the various functions of the non-protein coding DNA, and more are being published every week. You call it junk until you know what it does. I didn't put the slide up here, but there was a period of time, not too long ago, 100 years ago, where the human body supposedly had over 150 vestigial organs. These were things that were left over from evolution. These were parts of our body that we didn't need. Tonsils, adenoids, appendices, all those kinds of junk, tailbone. Those are some just off the top of my head. We don't think those are junk anymore. We need them. We need all those things. It just takes time to figure out, what do they do? What purpose do they serve? And they're all needed today. Because when we remove one, we have basically, yeah, we can function, but we're not as precisely able to deal with things as we could if we had all these parts. And so again, all I'm trying to point out here is that with time, we will understand things better, and the understanding will continue to point to an intelligent designer behind what we observe in nature. And there's a website that you can go to get more information on this book. But this is up to date. It's kind of neat to go back and see what some of our founders of science thought about God. This is a quote from Sir Isaac Newton, and there's a internet source that has a list of what Nobel winners have said about God. And Isaac Newton, he kind of said, the most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. And then down there, the last paragraph here, atheism seems so senseless. When I look at the solar system, I see the Earth at the right distance from the sun to receive the proper amount of heat and light. That did not happen by chance. I have a fundamental belief in the Bible as the Word of God, written by men who were inspired. I study the Bible daily. Isaac Newton, the founder of classical physics and infinitesimal calculus, believed in God, read his Bible daily. It's the Word of God. Recently, 2001, there's a book that's been published. It's called In 6 Days. And Stephen Jay Gould, a Harvard professor, claims that any professionally trained scientist virtually to a person understand the factual basis of evidence and don't dispute it. This book refutes that statement with essays from 50 doctorate-holding scientists from around the globe. These are men who are willing to write, I believe in God, I believe in a six-day creation of the universe by God. And you can read it. And it's not that old. Is it reasonable to believe in God? I left the word out. In this age of enlightenment, Romans 1:20 is more than reasonable, is more reasonable than ever. Everywhere we look, from the microscope, from the microscopic to the microscopic things, they look like they are made. A loud, clear, piercing cry of design. And these are some quotes from Michael Behe, who wrote a book a number of years ago now, which was called Darwin's Black Box. And he's a biochemist. And so there are men out there now who are willing to put their name down and write things from their field of perspective, their science field, that they believe in the existence of a God, and they think the evidence outweighs the evidence for evolution as being an explanation. We're going to sing number 10. Actually, we're going to sing number 9. Number 9, as an invitation. And it's a book. It's a song. It's titled "Our God, He is Alive." It's one of my favorites to sing and lead. And I found this out just recently. Maybe a lot of people know this. It was written by a fellow whose name was Dicus. He lived between 1888 and 1978. So, in my era, I wasn't born that long ago, but he was certainly around for a good portion of my life. And it turns out he invented the turn signal in 1918. I think they hung it on horses in those days. Anyway, and he has a PhD in physics from the University of Indiana. Good school, 1929. And he became chairman of the physics department of Tennessee Tech from 1929 to about 1946, just after the war. And I don't know if any of you know anything about Tennessee, but during the war years, there's a famous place there, it's still famous, called Oak Ridge National Laboratories. It's where the atomic bomb, one of the places where the atomic bomb was developed. They did the purification of the uranium. A lot of the other work was done in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at the laboratory there. He trained, you know, as a professor in physics. He taught courses in nuclear physics, trained a lot of the people that Oak Ridge National Laboratories hired and did a lot of that fundamental work in nuclear physics. But he gave that job up in 1946, and again, it's approximate, but that's when Florida College was founded. And he remained academic dean there until 1954. And in addition to that, he's a gospel preacher since 1925, and probably preached up until the end of his life. Wrote several songs, wrote several books. A physicist, a scientist. No question, as we sing this song, you listen to the words, you're going to see he's a believer in God. Do you believe in God? I hope so. Have you taken advantage of God's plan of salvation? Some of us have, some of us will. This is a time that we've set aside to encourage people to take advantage of the gospel, the good news about Jesus. And if you're subject to the gospel call, Let us know as we stand and sing, "Our God, He is alive."